This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Later today, the Pentagon is expected to announce an increase in U.S. troop levels in Iraq from about 138,000 now to 150,000. Some troops scheduled to rotate home will stay on a bit longer, and fresh units from the 82nd Airborne Division will be sent in to provide additional security for the period leading up to the elections, which are scheduled for the end of January. This decision will put additional strain on what many say is an already overstretched force and points up the necessity for new recruits. Amid a controversial conflict that shows no signs of easing, military recruiters are offering bigger bonuses and better benefits, spending more money to advertise and focusing their efforts, targeting high schools in poorer areas of the country while spending fewer resources at schools where most students go on to college. Later in the program, an update from Ukraine, where the two rival candidates for president appear to reach an agreement today. But first, military recruiting. We're going to be speaking with two former officers about the difficulties and tactics of recruiting in wartime and with a high school guidance counselor, and we want to hear from you. If you're in school or just out, call and tell us if you've been recruited. We'd also like to hear from parents, teachers, and from recruiters as well. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us first is Richard Stark, who tracks military personnel issues for the Center for Strategic and International Study. He joins us here in Studio 3A, and nice of you to come in today.
Neil, it's great to be here.
Let's start with that announcement from the Pentagon, scheduled for about an hour from now. How taxing is this kind of a troop increase on the force as it exists now?
Well, it's taxing in two ways. Number one, it increases the overall number of troops who are deployed away from their family and their loved ones. It also will likely involve delaying the return of some. So, in other words, extending the length of those deployments. Overall, they are looking to have a surge capacity, and they'll do that two ways, by moving troops there early and delaying the return of others.
And this is essentially during the rotation. You keep both elements there. So you've got a bolstered force for what everybody expects to be a very difficult period leading up to the elections.
Correct. A larger and longer overlap that provides you a surplus of troops above which they've experienced in the past year or so.
The number of Americans killed in Iraq last month, this was as bad a month as there has been thus far. The 2 months that have been terrible, worst thus far in Iraq, both have one single element to unite them, which is Fallujah, April and November. But these casualties certainly have to add to the stress, to the force, and to the difficulty of recruiting, don't they?
I'm not so sure, Neil. You know, the motivation for most young people to join the military is for the educational opportunity, the opportunity to learn a skill, to be part of something larger than themselves. These are the things that seem to draw young men and women to military life and keep them there. But quality of life is an important aspect of it, and I think it's the length and the duration, length, duration, and frequency, of the deployments that is what eats away at the quality of life for members of the active components as well as the reserve components. While we all watch the news with agony as we watch the toll of those who are killed and the seven or eight times that number that are wounded, I don't think that's the principal motivator for the service members. However, it does impact on families.
Tell us, how are the various branches of the military doing in terms of their quotas for recruits?
Well, in 2004, all except the Army National Guard finished meeting their goals. I believe the Army Reserve and the Army had to press hard in the stretch to meet their 2004 goal. The Army National Guard, importantly, fell short of its goal by some 12%, about 7,000. And this is caused by two factors. One, those people who would normally leave active duty, and there are about 7,000 or 8,000 who are affected by stop loss in the active duty today, some part of those, perhaps half, might otherwise go into the National Guard. But as they look at the National Guard, if they're affected by stop loss, they're not leaving active duty. If they look at the National Guard and see a high likelihood of deployment, they may be deterred from choosing to join the National Guard. And so the National Guard has had to increase those that they acquire from non-prior service, people with no previous military training. That then creates a dynamic where they're competing for high school graduates at a higher level with the active Army and the other services than they have in the past. You begin to create something of a perfect storm where people are drawing on the same pool because of the stop loss.
And just to remind people, stop loss is an order that the military issues from time to time during a conflict, saying basically, even though you may be scheduled to depart from the service, guess what, you're not. And some people have complained that the excessive use of this, what they say is excessive use, amounts to a backdoor draft.
Well, our military manpower demands today are high. They're very high by any account. Stop loss is one description for a policy that essentially allows you to retain trained manpower. Now, if you look at the alternative, and I'm not that critical of stop loss, if you look at the alternative to allow someone to leave active duty and they go and they choose not to go into the National Guard or Reserves and they join that manpower pool of about 300,000 people that are what we call the individual ready reserve. They're not actively part of a reserve or National Guard unit. We've begun to tap into that manpower pool. So the fact that they're leaving active duty and not going into the National Guard and are affected by stop loss to some degree, that just means that we don't have to dip as far into the IRR for people who have left service recently and whose skills may still be fresh.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get back to recruiting. As we mentioned at the top, the difficulty for the military, is that reflected in their increasing efforts? They're spending more money, retargeting what they're doing?
Well, you know, for some years, the General Accounting Office has been critical of recruiting expenditures. The DOD, Department of Defense, spends some $2.5 billion for recruiters, advertising, bonuses, administration of various tests before initial entry on active duty. Taken together, I think the Army is spending something on the order of $600 million a year now for advertising alone, and almost an equal number for bonuses. The other services get by with far less advertising and far less bonuses. And this is a nature of the privation that's associated with Army duty. It's on the ground, longer deployments. The GAO's criticism has been that while the Army in the late 1990s was challenged by a very strong economy, which is going to challenge us again today in recruiting, the recruiting challenges that we face will be impacted by our lack of full understanding of what's the best way to spend each dollar. Is it on a bonus, or is it on more advertising, or is it on more recruiters? In fact, the Army is dramatically increasing all three of those.
If you'd like to join our conversation, by the way, let me repeat the phone number. It's 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And well, let's talk with Robert, who's on the line with us from Minnetonka, Minnesota.
Hello.
Hi, Robert.
Okay, you guys are talking about how recruiting practices are run, kind
mm-hmm.
of thing?
Yep.
Okay, I was recruited by the Army early when I was a junior.
In high school?
Yes. And I decided not to do that because the current situation in Iraq and all that. But later, I found out that I wouldn't have liked college as much as I probably would have. So I decided to look at the military again. So is what I did is I called the recruiter for the Marine Corps, and I went over and talked with them, and I was fascinated. So I've actually enlisted with the Marine Corps, and I leave actually on this Sunday to go to boot camp.
Well, I guess a little bit of nerves at this moment, Robert?
Yeah, it's nerve-wracking, but on the same time, it's like, you know, I want to get it over with kind of a thing.
Yeah. What went through your mind? I mean, as you said, you reconsidered college and then reconsidered the military, but
mm-hmm.
obviously the risks are still there, the same risks that you considered the first time.
Oh, yeah, they're still there, but, you know, I've grown up a lot since then, and I've realized that, you know, it could happen anywhere, you know?
Get run over by a bus there in Minnetonka.
Yeah, you know, but I'd rather, you know, die doing something that actually meant something, you know, serve your country, die for your country, you know, made something of yourself kind of a thing.
Robert, this is Rick Stark. Could I ask you, do you still intend to pursue your plans for college at some point?
Yes, I do. because the Montgomery GI Bill, which allows me, you know, to go to college during the military service, I'm actually looking forward to doing that also while I'm serving in the Marine Corps.
And one more question about the recruiting process. You say you were approached by recruiters from the Army. When you made your decision, you approached recruiters from the Marines. Was that experience different?
It actually was. When I went, like, the Army came to my high school, and basically it's like the first time I talked to them, I basically got enlisted almost. You know, I got all the information. I was just like, whoa, you know, you guys are moving a little fast, huh? So I decided not to pursue that one.
Mm-hmm.
But later I went on the internet, requested information from the Marine Corps, and I was contacted, and I decided, you know, why not, you know?
Okay, Robert. Well, good luck.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Be safe, Robert.
I will.
Joining us now on the line is Major General retired Robert Scales. He worked in the military's Training and Doctrine Command. That's the agency responsible for recruiting when he was in the military. And he joins us now by phone from Baltimore, Maryland. And General Scales, nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Well, it's good to be back. Thank you for inviting me.
How does the military identify the young men and women it wants to recruit?
Well, I think you've just seen an example of that with Robert on the line. They, you know, it's sort of like you go to where the kids are, and that's principally high schools, juniors and seniors, as well as junior colleges and some universities, because most of the Army's recruits come in between the ages of about 18 and 22, and usually the easiest recruiting is done right out of high school as young men and women mature and they get older and perhaps they begin families and so forth, or they get embedded in a particular profession. It gets more and more difficult the older they get.
Are some high schools more productive in terms of recruits than others?
I mean, it's an interesting fact that historically the Army has recruited heavily from the Southeast and the Southwest, and to a lesser extent in the Midwest, and less in the more populated states like in the Northeast and on the West Coast. So
those tend to be the more prosperous states as well.
Prosperous, that's right. And also there is a great tradition of military service in the Southeast going back many, many years, and oftentimes recruiting is hereditary in the sense that fathers, uncles, and other relations and folks in the neighborhood served in the Army, so a young kid is brought up either with the expectation or some familiarity with the Army, and they tend to follow in the footsteps of their older relatives.
I have an email here from Bill in Hickory, North Carolina. I live in a mostly poor rural area. I'm convinced the military recruiters have never been as underhanded and dishonest in their tactics as they have been during the last 12 months. My 19-year-old nephew was approached and eventually recruited after being promised a computer job in the Army, only to end up driving a truck. He leaves for Iraq in 3 weeks and has great regrets about falling for the recruiter's dishonest ploy. Obviously, you can't speak to that individual case.
Well, you can't talk about the individuals, but a couple of points. When a soldier is recruited, he's given a battery of exams, and it's called the ASFAB. And this exam determines where the soldier's particular skills are. And then a soldier is offered various slots in different shortages, different openings based on his particular skill set, and he signs a contract. And when the soldier signs a contract, the contract clearly states what particular military operational specialty or MOS that soldier will join. So, I mean, you can't really say what a recruiter said to him, but when he does come to a recruiting station and he takes a battery of tests and he's counseled on what job he's going to perform, that counseling session is very scripted, it's very straightforward, and it is a legal document. It's a contract, and so therefore there are very strict rules that deal with how those contracts are passed on to the prospective soldier.
Okay. I would just add, Neil, that,
and very quickly,
I'm Rick Stark from,
and very quickly,
I would simply add that, I mean, we have to match the skills of the individual with the needs of the service.
Okay, we'll be back with more after a short break. We're talking about military recruiting. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, TOTN at npr.org. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about military recruitment and how the situation in Iraq affects the military's efforts to find new recruits. Our guests are Richard Stark, who tracks military personnel issues at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's with us here in Studio 3A. And also with us is Bob Scales, a retired Major General who used to work in the military's Training and Doctrine Command, the agency in charge of recruiting. He's with us by phone from Baltimore. Of course, you're all invited to join us. 800-989-8255. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Jan. Jan's calling from Boston, Massachusetts.
Hi.
Hi, Jan.
Hi. I was just calling. When I graduated from college with a degree in computer science in 2000, all of my classmates, you know, were heavily recruited every day, it seemed, in the mail by mostly the Navy's nuclear programs. And the offers just kept getting better and better and better as graduation day appeared. But in the end, none of us went for it. And it was mostly the lack of control that we would have had afterwards, and that if we could have kind of chosen where we would have been stationed or where, you know, we could have gone for a while, I think it would have made a big difference. But nobody wanted to have to be pulled away from their families.
Which is kind of the nature of military service in some respects.
Well, you all knew you might have to go eventually, but, you know, for longer-term deployments or, you know, stateside, you didn't have a choice of where you would go. I think if there had been a little bit more choice, people would have signed up for it.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, you know, and then I just applied to medical school, and I thought, oh, I'll go maybe, you know, look into military because it's mostly because it's paid for. But then with Iraq, I said, there's no way, ever.
Okay, Jan, thanks very much.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. General Scales and Rick Stark, you can weigh in on this too. Obviously, she's talking about a particular specialty that is more or less exclusive to the Navy, nuclear specialist, but I guess every branch of the service encounters this with different specialties.
Yeah, if I could be the first to comment on that, that's right. I mean, there are really two issues when you recruit a person. The first is, what's the military specialty, and secondly, where are you going to be assigned? And the Navy, of course, deals with very long term deployments, usually 6 months to 8 months. They're almost always at sea,
mm-hmm.
and that's a negative. Of course, the good news is that you know, very few sailors face the prospect of violent death in Iraq, and the Navy is obviously a more technical service than the Army, and things like computers, communications, intelligence, and things of that sort require more emphasis in the Navy and therefore garner more people.
Mm-hmm. Rick, did you want to weigh in?
Well, I just, you know, there are a number of specialties, as General Scales points out, also in the medical field, nuclear field, and a variety of others where we recruit in colleges, for lawyers, for instance. And this can be challenging because these people already have their education pretty well sorted out. They're not coming in for an educational benefit so much as for the experience. And I think in the future, we do need to think about how we can ensure we have access to that population. And there are some areas where we're not as competitive as the civilian world is.
Mm-hmm. Here's another email of this from Nicole Goodrich. My husband has recruited for the Army and is now recruiting for the National Guard. The qualifications to get into the Army are so tough, it's no wonder we're shorthanded. It's a different kind of Army than it used to be. Most young adults that seek out recruiters are not qualified. Perhaps the standards are too high. Rick Stark, what do you think?
Well, no, I would argue that the standards are not too high. It's true. We have the finest Army we've ever had, the finest military across the board, and that's no accident. That is a result of the all-volunteer force, people who volunteer, they choose to be in uniform, and they, over a period of time, decide whether that is going to become a career for them. And they are highly committed, and they cherish the camaraderie and the experience. Those who don't choose to leave. The fact that we have a very rigorous training program and selection process for various skills and promotion is why we have the military that we have today. We should be grateful for the all-volunteer force.
Yeah, and if I could make another comment, I was in the Army in the early 70s when the military recruiting system simply melted down. and they have different intelligence categories that the Army uses to sort of to place soldiers, and Category 4 is the lowest. And there was a time when in the early 70s when the Army was well over 50% Cat 4, the lowest middle category, and the Army was, to put it mildly, dysfunctional in those days. And all of us who have served in the military remember how bad the Army was in the early 70s, right after Vietnam, and that's what led to this, some would call it an obsession with ensuring that we maintain quality, mm-hmm. particularly when you deal with a force that's as small as the Army. You have a force that's less than 500,000 men and women that has global responsibilities, and you cannot afford to lower your standards in, when you're in a force like that, because two things will happen. The mission won't get done, and people will get killed. And I've lived through the bad days of the all-volunteer Army, and I'm thankful for what we have today, and we should never go back.
Mm-hmm. Let me bring up another email. This we have from Jamie. I did a year-long tour in Iraq, 17-month deployment as part of a National Guard Army unit. It was a miserable experience, and it has had profound impact on my family life. Of the 50-odd people in my unit, less than 5 have even used any of their education benefits. I am the anti-recruiter, he writes, and I've tried to influence young people to avoid military service. Is that true, Rick Stark, that few people use their educational benefits?
Well, one of the problems with the GI Bill is that the GI Bill is largely designed for, back at the end of World War II, to provide an educational opportunity for people after they leave service. Today, we need to provide an educational benefit that accrues to people while they're on active duty. We have a limited program, but I don't think it does all that it can. So there are certainly people who are unable on active duty with the deployment tempo that they experience today to take full advantage of the educational opportunities.
Mm-hmm. And, General, before we let you go, I did want to ask, during time of war, obviously risk is something that a recruiter needs to discuss with the potential recruit, no?
Well, that's true. And also remember, those who are most liable to get injured in warfare comprise a very small percent of even the Army. And that's principally the infantry and the armor and a couple of other branches. But you're only talking about somewhere between, probably 11 to 14% of the Army and about the similar percentage of the Marine Corps, and something less than 5 or 6% of the total force that's enlisted within the DOD. But there's a huge disparity in relative risk within the Army and the Marine Corps. Some who do the dirty business of fighting in cities like Fallujah and Sadr City have a much higher risk factor than those who, say, are running a computer station in Baghdad, or perhaps working in a military hospital. So there are different levels of risk, and I think, in my opinion at least, the surest way to ensure quality in those high-risk MOSs is to pay them more, either as a bonus or to pay them a higher salary, because they're the ones who shoulder the majority of the greatest burden of risk.
General Scales, thanks very much, as always.
Thanks a lot. We'll see you later, Neil.
Bob Scales worked in the Training and Doctrine Command, the agency responsible for military recruitment. He resigned as the rank of Major General, and he joined us by phone from Baltimore, Maryland. To get a sense of how schools help students decide whether or not to enlist in the military, we turn now to Jan Tkazik, who directs the Guidance Counselor Program at Cape Cod Regional Technical High School in Harwich, Massachusetts. She's with us by phone from her office in Harwich, and thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Give us some idea of the kind of students you have at your school. What's is this a prosperous community?
We have 725 students, 9 through 12. We have 12 sending towns, Mashpee to Provincetown here on Cape Cod, and we have about a third of our students on free and reduced lunch. We follow up our graduates every year, so I can tell you with some authority that approximately 70% each year go on directly out to work, and about 20 to 25% go to further education, and then somewhere in around 4 or 5% choose the military.
4 or 5%.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of presence do recruiters have in your school?
We have a very strong, positive relationship with all of our recruiters, I'm pleased to say. I've been here for 30 years at Cape Cod Tech, so I have some history with this issue. And I can tell you that because they've always respected the parameters that we've set, they have access to our students, appropriate access, as all other recruiters, whether it's apprenticeship programs, athletic programs, post-secondary institutions. You know, it's all about providing the students with the information that they need to make the choices for them.
When you talk about the parameters the school sets, what are those?
Well, if it's a college or a military recruiter or what have you, they're to call my office and let us know in advance when they would like to come in. And in the case of the colleges and the military recruiters, we allow them to set up a table in the cafeteria, and we allow students free access to approach them and pick up material and ask questions that they have. So as long as they've notified us that they're coming, we get a table set up for them. And as long as they don't, you know, as none of them have, go out into the cafeteria and approach students, you know, who may not be interested, we have no problem.
Do they ask information from you about the students, so they might find out who's more interested than they might be most interested in?
Well, under the Family Education Rights and Privacy Act, we have the obligation to provide them with information, but to allow parents who choose to restrict information about their youngster, you know, that we have here that we might send out. So we always follow those guidelines, and of course those are prescribed by the American School Counselors Association. I happen to be their regional vice president for the North Atlantic, and we represent over 17,000 school counselors around the country. And we have a position statement on professional school counselor and student recruitment. And so we watch those FERPA guidelines. We make sure that the students in all areas have as much information as we can provide them and their parents. And that includes not just the recruiters coming in during the day, but also we have a big fair here for the kids in Hyannis, which is sort of the center of Cape Cod. And parents and students are encouraged to go to this fair, which is post-secondary, and it has both colleges and military recruiters there as well.
So they see they have other options.
Exactly.
Yeah. Here's an email question which you may be able to answer from Mark Kaur in San Jose, California. Is it true that high school students that are identified as low performers through the No Child Left Behind are being targeted by the military for recruitment?
Not at all. That hasn't been my experience. In fact, before you called, I double-checked with the school counselors on my staff to make sure that I had the pulse of not only the experience that I've had with my students, but theirs as well. And the students, we're not hearing complaints about students getting phone calls from the military. We're not, in fact, we're getting very good reports from our students when they come out of basic training and or when they're home on other military leaves, that what's been represented or presented to them by the military is then their experience.
That doesn't surprise me, Neil, simply because the military has a goal of 60% of its recruits being high quality. High quality being a two-part test: one, that they're a high school graduate, and two, that they score in the upper 50% of the aptitude test. So taken together, I find it hard to believe that they would routinely go out of their way to target poor-performing students.
We're talking about military recruitment, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And as we continue, Jen Tkacic, as you talk with students who are profess some interest in a military career, do you also go through some explanations with them about the risks involved? Do you make sure their parents are involved in this?
Absolutely. With any post-secondary decision, but specifically those that relate to college and military options, because there's, you know, it's a more serious process that they're going through. In colleges, they're signing applications and committing some financial obligations there. And when it's the military, of course, they're signing on the dotted line, and that's a legal contract, and obligating themselves to service. And so, particularly in these times, we want to make it clear to kids and to their parents that they need to be thorough in the questions that they ask as far as what the youngsters can expect, if depending upon what branch they're pursuing.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Joe, and Joe is in Farmington, Michigan.
Hi, how you doing?
All right.
Take my call.
Sure.
I was a naval officer for a little more than 6 years and often had to deal with the results of poor recruiting. And let me say, I have great respect for the recruiters, as I do for anyone who is in the service, but they're under a tremendous pressure to produce bodies. And that pressure also comes with a carrot. They're given financial promotion and other awards and incentives for meeting recruiting requirements, and those often get in the way of being honest with recruits and with producing the best recruits possible.
Rick Stark, let's stop right there, Joe. Rick Stark, is that accurate? Is there a commission per recruit?
Well, Joe, let me ask you this first. When did you serve?
I got out of the service in 2002 and served from 96 until 2002.
Yeah, you happened to serve at a very challenging time. During the late 1990s, we had a very strong economy. In fact, it was almost as challenging a recruiting environment as we probably will see this next year. So I'm not surprised that you saw some degradation in the overall quality, because the late 90s, that certainly existed.
Well, I would agree with you, except this is a complaint that has probably been made about recruiters since, you know, before men went on ships and went to sea. Military recruiting has always had problems, and once a recruit gets into the service, there's nothing that can be done for him because the Navy or the other services can say, I'm sorry, whatever the recruiter promised you, we can't give you. National security overrides that. And no one wants to listen to the legitimate complaints of a recruit who was lied to or misdirected once he's already signed his recruiting contract.
Yeah. Well, I would just point out that the contract spells out the precise schooling and assignment that most recruits are going to experience. So what a recruiter tells you, I can't vouch for, but certainly, as in any enterprise that has humans involved in it, there are probably some who stretch the rules.
We just have a few seconds left, but Jen Tkazik, your returning students, have they complained about these kind of problems?
Not in the 30 years that I've been in this chair. We've been very, very pleased with the experience that our kids have had. They come back standing tall and proud. And, that would be something I would take up with the recruiters. The first instance that I had any negative response, I think because we work so hard to keep the parents in the loop and to make sure that the kids really know what options they're pursuing. We haven't had that issue here.
Joe, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And Jan Tkazik, we need to thank you for your time today as well. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Jan Tkazik directs the Guidance Counselor Program at Cape Cod Regional Technical High School in Harwich, Massachusetts, and joined us by phone from her office there. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Right now we're going to wrap up our conversation about military recruitment. Our guest is Richard Stark, an expert on these issues at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's with us here in Studio 3A, and we wanted to take a call with John. John's calling from San Antonio, Texas.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I just had a comment that, first of all, I wanted to say that my recruiter was really good. He answered all the questions that I had for him very truthfully.
And which service was it?
I'm in the Air Force. I was actually a student at Princeton University when the attacks of September 11th occurred, and I took a leave of absence and enlisted in the Air Force as a linguist. Now, I qualified for Arabic, I volunteered for Arabic, and I was assigned Arabic in boot camp, but when I arrived at the Defense Language Institute, they actually ended up putting me in a Spanish class. So my comment would simply be that no matter how many documents you sign or how much something makes sense, nothing really is a sure thing in the military until it actually happens. And so I've had a great experience serving my country. People should know that when they're going into this. You know.
Well, language specialist is still a language specialist, John.
Yes, it is. But, going into, fighting... Sorry.
At least you're not handed an M16 and say, see in Fallujah. You know, there's a difference there.
Certainly there is, but I guess considering the languages that are important in the war on terrorism to qualify for Arabic and then end up in Spanish. And at any rate,
well, this is a Rick Stark, a classic example, I guess. People are always confused by many of the things that are done in the military.
Well, first of all, it surprises me somewhat that they would have decided not to train him in Arabic because there's a dearth of those in the military today. But there may have been a pressing need for someone of his qualifications to liaise with Spanish forces. We were working with Spanish forces in Iraq and elsewhere. So I can't speak to that particular decision. But, mm-hmm. Yes, the needs of the service oftentimes change, and the forces have to be used as efficiently and effectively as they can be. I think it is important, though, that the recruiting commands learn from reports about where recruits may feel they've been led astray, because it's important to continue good relationships with schools and with those who join. Good PR is an important part of recruiting, and I would urge them where they could redouble those efforts to ensure they get to the bottom of those issues.
And, John, obviously people should pay a great deal of attention to what their recruiter tells them.
Oh, certainly. And like I said, my recruiter did a great job. It was just, you know, once you get in, it was almost kind of a catch-22 situation where you qualify for what you think is a pressing need, and then they end up putting you in another place. But thank you very much for taking
that. One final question, John. Are you still in the Air Force?
Yes, I am. I have one more year left.
And after you leave, do you plan to use the educational benefits you may have gotten?
I'm certainly going to use the GI Bill to help me pay for my remaining 2 years at Princeton. So certainly to that extent, I'm definitely going to.
Well, hasta la vista.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Good luck to you, John.
And one final email question for you, Rick Stark. This from Spencer Dill, or perhaps Dill Spencer, I'm not so sure. I'm a freshman in college from Albany, California. I've been sought after by many recruiters, and I was wondering, do they have access to background information on any high school or college students?
Well, I think as our high school or college or our high school counselor pointed out, that access to that information is largely restricted if the family or the individual doesn't choose to be contacted. Their name and address is not provided. Generally, what we're talking about is job fairs, mailings, phone calls, or an address, an educational briefing, if you will, to lay out the general benefits. For someone to be buttonholed, if you will, against their will, that strikes me as somewhat unusual. By and large, these privacy restrictions preclude that.
Rick Stark, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Richard Stark is the Center for Strategic and International Studies here in Washington and was kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A.